Hello and welcome to the Women in Sport podcast. Our vision is that no one is excluded from the joy, fulfilment and lifelong benefits of sport. It's June 2024 and this year marks Women in Sport's 40th anniversary. Women and girls belong in sport, but gender stereotypes and institutional bias hold us back. Misogyny is a significant barrier. But we believe that when sport includes women and girls, it helps tackle health inequalities. And it is just wrong to deny women and girls access to sport. This episode is about what needs to be done to eradicate misogyny from sport and society in general. My name is Julia George. I'm a journalist, broadcaster, and former gymnast. Welcome to the Women in Sport podcast.
Undeniably, Andrew Tate and Joey Barton are misogynists, but they're not the only thing that misogyny can look like.
If it's because you want it to be about you and you want to be this great male ally and, hey, look at me, I'm such a good lad, then no, you're going about it the wrong way.
We're not the ones harassing ourselves. We're not the ones sending ourselves horrible sexualized comments on X or on Instagram or whatever. It's male behaviour that needs to change.
What I think has changed is women's refusal to put up with it and to complain and issue concerns about it.
It's been a long-held goal of women in sport to stamp out misogyny. But a quick look at the comments on the social media accounts of world-class female sports stars and grassroots women's sports teams shows you just how much anti-female sentiment persists in our society in 2024. So what's to be done? With me are Fiona Scolding KC. Fiona has worked on issues around safeguarding, particularly in education, for a long time. She's worked in law for over 20 years, notably as lead counsel to three different investigations at the Independent Inquiry for Child Sexual Abuse. Fiona also represented nearly 300 individuals and the Hepatitis C Trust in the Infected Blood Inquiry. Hugo Monnier is a rugby union international who has capped 14 times for England and played 241 times for Harlequins, winning the Premiership title in 2012 before retiring in 2015. He's made a successful switch to TV, and you may have seen him on Strictly Come Dancing in 2021. And Rachel Williams works for Women in Sport. She leads our work on developing policy positions and our relationship with political and policy-making stakeholders right across the UK and at all levels of government. With the general election just a few days away, Rachel is very busy. Welcome, all of you, to our podcast. Hugo, I'd love to start with you. You're a big supporter of women's sport. Have you always been, or was there a particular moment?
There definitely was a moment. I think for me, it was, I remember when George Floyd got murdered and there was perhaps the world's largest ever protest against racism. And I found myself repeatedly saying, like, this isn't just a black person's problem. Like, we need everyone, really, if we want to be able to solve this pandemic, which has been carrying on for thousands of years. So I think the minute you ask something of someone, you've got to ask yourself the same question. Are you doing everything to be able to support other movements, other causes? And ultimately, the one thing I've asked of lots of people is to care for things that don't necessarily impact yourself. And that was a question that I had to put to myself. And whilst I was a supporter of women's sport, was I vocal enough? Was I active enough? That was perhaps the moment where I did dial it up just a little bit.
Fiona, let's talk about the law. You've worked, I said, over 20 years, probably nearer 30 in the law. Has it felt at times, perhaps even early in your career, a misogynistic place to be?
I wouldn't describe it as misogynistic, but I would describe it as heavily unequal. I mean, there are still significantly more men than women at senior levels in our profession. I think it's gone from under 10% of women being KCs, which is what I am, to around 20% of women. But as somebody said to me last week, there were more men called Christopher who were KCs than there were entire women in certain areas of law. So it springs from men. We wear a male outfit when we go to court. The wigs and gowns gowns aren't female outfits, they're male 17th century or early 18th century outfits. So the default is still male rather than female.
We've tackled you and your world of misogyny. What about you and sport? Are you a sporty person? Have you been a sporty person in your life?
I am one of the least sporty people you can imagine. I do exercise now that I'm in my early 50s, because I need to do that for my own health and well-being. But I would say I'm exactly the sort of person who women in sport would say was excluded from school sports. I was always the fat kid, the slow kid, the kid with glasses who fell over a lot. So really, from a very early age, I was impliedly excluded from certainly anything that amounted to competitive sport. But I like watching it.
Rachel, I think before I get on to women in sport and the definition of misogyny, I just want to bring you in on what Fiona just said there, because that does speak to why we're here, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we could start a support group, because that is exactly my story as well. You know, I was the tall but fat, very, very intelligent. So therefore, you're not interested in sport, are you? You want to go and do music. You want to be in the choir. You want to be in the band. And you can't do sport as well. The reason that I wanted to work for women in sport, and why I'm so proud to, is because I want that experience to not be the norm for the next generation of girls. And unfortunately, you know, our research shows that it still is. The dropout for teenage girls is phenomenal. And that's tragic. And that's something that we want to solve.
We're focusing in this podcast on misogyny, and we'll come on as well to the role of regulation in sport and the role perhaps of an independent regulator, something the charity is calling for. Let's start with misogyny. How does Women in Sport define that term?
So I think if I went out onto the street now and asked your average punter what a misogynist looked like, they would give me two names, and those two names would be Andrew Tate, and if they were sporty, Joey Barton. Now, undeniably, Andrew Tate and Joey Barton are misogynists, but they're not the only thing that misogyny can look like. So the way that we prefer to talk about what misogyny means is that it's prejudice, it's malice, it's contempt for women and girls. And above everything else, it's about preserving the power structures that exist in society at the moment, preserving in particular the power that men have. And this is why it finds a little home for itself in sport, because obviously sport has traditionally been, and still is in many ways, a very male domain, was set up by men for men, bluntly. And that's why, as I say, it has managed to take root in sport. But it's also why sport could potentially be a big part of the solution.
Ugo, you inhabited a very elite male sporting environment. For the women who were part of rugby union and that whole setup, how were they treated? And what did you clock at the time? Were there improvements that could have been made when you were a player?
100%. And I was probably part of that problem as well. I think you indoctrinate yourself and you almost pick up the historical behaviours and acceptance levels, which ultimately facilitate the behaviours of today and the attitudes of today, which then form the attitudes of tomorrow. It was highly alpha, testosterone driven, and something I'm definitely so much more aware of now since I've retired. Now I work in broadcast, and I was actually in a green room about a month ago. There's this wonderful director called Sarah, and we're sat in the green room. Lads were chatting. She was the only female in the green room. And I called her a couple of days later and said, the environment you now co-inhabit with us, because you are part of that minority and I know what that feels like, is that okay? And she, I think, appreciated the fact that someone actually recognised that things perhaps need to be adhered to or looked at, or certainly a consideration towards it. But in a rugby change room, a career that started in 2001, I just don't think the acceptance level of what was then would be accepted today.
Fiona, you were nodding along to some of that. What did you want to draw upon when you were listening to Ugo then?
I do think that one of the primary issues that gets raised is by the time people get to Ugo's level, so they're elite sports people in their late teens, early 20s, those kinds of masculine patriarchal attitudes, the kind of laddie boys on tour, is already deeply embedded within our society. So we have to work, and this is why I think it's so important what goes on in schools, what goes on in nurseries, in order to dispel some of those try and find a different way for men to be with each other, which isn't kind of joyless, because I think one of the issues that often gets raised is you just want to introduce some sort of joylessness, but something which is joyful but doesn't involve denigrating women or having contempt for women built into it. And a lot of all male behaviours in sport are kind of the acme of masculinity, I suppose the apex of masculinity, in terms of implied violence in some cases, express violence in others, kind of boxing, hyper-masculine attitudes. And I think elite sport needs to do things to change that, and I think is doing things to change that. But also at the grassroots level, that needs to change.
This is shouting stereotyping at me, Rachel, and I think you're thinking the same thing, I'm sure. Absolutely. Women in Sport has talked about stereotyping for a long time, but some very interesting research and an interesting campaign earlier this year on this issue.
So what we did earlier this year was some research specifically with boys at primary school, so proper 5 to 11-year-old boys. And what we found with that was that these attitudes about sport being absolutely fundamental to your identity and winning being absolutely fundamental to your identity are built in so, so young with our boys. Literal 5-year-olds coming out with quotes about how women belong in the kitchen and boys play sport. And that doesn't come from nothing. It's exactly as you say, the education piece, the pieces are with the elite sport is increasingly doing. I think it's also with just a general conception of masculinity in our society. You know, the quote that always sticks with me from that primary boys research is actually one said by an adult. And it's an uncle of one of the boys who was interviewed saying, "You must beat the girls." And that was what sport was for him. It was about winning. It was about beating the girls. And the girls were the people that you absolutely needed to be better than. And until we can sort of challenge that conception of what sport is, until we can make sport a place where girls feel welcome, where boys kind of respect girls and will play with girls, will pass to them in the playground when they're playing football and all of that sort of stuff, then we're going to continue sort of having to have these discussions about misogyny in sport. But if we can break that at that early age, then the conversation changes.
Fiona, let's stay with young people. You were asked to take a really close look at misogyny among young people. Now, this was after the Everyone's Invited phenomenon. Just remind people about Everyone's Invited first, and then we'll go on to the work that you did.
Well, Everyone's Invited kind of came out of the movement following the murder of Sarah Everard, and was a response by a young woman called Somsara and some other young women who basically posted online their experiences of either sexual violence or harassment or insults or threats by men against them, both at schools and in university settings. And it went from there being a couple of girls who posted things to there being, I think it was something like 70,000 different complaints, as a result of which everybody, particularly in the education sector, where it wasn't something that was unknown, had to take a really long, hard look at themselves. And I think fundamentally what stood out to me from that was that there was a whole generation of women who were not prepared to put up with the kind of inherently misogynistic attitudes and approaches that very many teenage boys and men show to them. Now, I don't know whether it's worse, better than it was 40 or 50 years ago. What I think has changed is women's refusal to put up with it and to complain and issue concerns about it. And I certainly think what that entire movement did was make schools think, probably for the first time, about how do we manage the relationship between boys and girls in classrooms? How do we make sure that women are safe? How do we make sure that things like bottom groping, bra twanging, kind of everyday things...
Pantsing? Did you come across pantsing?
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole line of things that make you feel slightly ill when you read them to do with the way that teenage boys talk to teenage girls. Now, what also is new is the rise of the social media misogynic influencer, i.e. Andrew Tate. And certainly it would appear that a lot of younger men between the ages of 13 and 15 were very heavily influenced by that, by those narratives, which were overly misogynistic and deeply troubling. and they just swallowed them because that was the way to be a man.
Let's talk about confronting these things then. Let's start to talk about how misogyny is tackled in sport and beyond. Ugo, have you had to or wanted to confront other men?
Absolutely. I think a lot of the conversation, I don't know if it's a term, but it sounds like we're perhaps talking about like your micro misogyny, your everyday, the things that just happen and have been almost acceptable for a little while. Therefore, like, what are you talking about? I have confronted people. I have questioned people. But what's more important than confronting and questioning is actually how you do it. So when I've heard conversations or seen attitudes, I think if I was to stop people in their tracks there and then and make a massive deal about it, and to the extent where you could potentially embarrass people, I actually think you have the total opposite effect. I think if you pull people to one side quietly, and that's just done out of respect, because what is the reasoning behind you stopping and checking someone or questioning someone or actually provoking their thinking? If it's because you want it to be about you, and you want to be this great male ally, and hey, look at me, I'm such a good lad, then no, you're going about it the wrong way. If you just want to pull someone to a side, you're actually doing it in such a respectful way that I think truly lands. And I think that would be my advice. That's been my experience. And also, that's exactly what I'd want someone to do for me. We do live in a world where people feel as if you're not allowed to make mistakes anymore. And a lot of the mistakes that I often see will be genuine mistakes or just through ignorance, because people feel as if you make that mistake, you could lose your job, you could lose your career. I think we need to show a level of respect and grace. If you feel as if someone is making a genuine mistake, in order for them to do better and also to pass on that as well.
Fiona, this is an interesting point, isn't it, about the fact that mistakes are made and a degree of forgiveness and understanding and handling things in a compassionate way is important. You work in the law. This is where there is great power to correct problems. What do you make of what Ugo just said?
When I think about the young men that I've met when I've done various reviews and reports about misogyny in school, what they need is education, compassion and thought. They don't need to be criminalised, I think, necessarily always for their behaviours, because I don't think that necessarily makes any difference. And I agree. I think there is a place to stand up and say things publicly. Although I agree, I don't think you should ever do it in order to deliberately humiliate someone. I do think there is a space, particularly for teaching staff and older pupils, to say it to younger pupils. But I do think ultimately what's important is that we take men with us on this journey to tackle misogyny. And to simply humiliate men will be to reinforce, they will go back into the trenches, so to speak, and they will double down on those kinds of behaviours.
At Women in Sport, how important are male allies?
Oh, phenomenally important. And I have to say, whenever I hear or get to see Ugo speak, it just makes me feel so happy. I'm not going to lie. This is not a women's problem. And one of the reasons why I think sport and lots of other industries has been so slow to kind of twig and start trying to tackle it is because it's always been treated as a women's problem. But at the end of the day, we're not the ones harassing ourselves. We're not the ones sending ourselves horrible sexualized comments on X or on Instagram or whatever. It's male behaviour that needs to change. And, you know, we're absolutely correct that we can't humiliate men and to take them with us. Again, coming back to the research that we did with primary school boys, that we also spoke to some teaching staff as part of that. And one of the things that they really pulled out was the lack of positive male role models for boys. And that's really difficult. So male allies are really important. Male role models are really important. And I think I have to speak on this topic more than I would like, to be completely honest. And one of the things that I often say is that for an ordinary man in the street, one of the most powerful things you can do is be a positive role model to the younger men in your life, whether they are your kids, you know, your nephews, or just younger friends, sons of friends, all of that sort of thing. Any man that those young boys and young men see could be a role model for them. So actually, generally being nice and respectful is one of the most powerful ways to be a male ally.
We've all talked about misogyny being a significant barrier for women in sport and in wider society. Let's start to look at some of the solutions, the levers, if you like, that can bring about change. There will be advantages and disadvantages to some of them. Let's talk about the law, Fiona. Are there risks and benefits to an idea around criminalising misogynistic behaviour?
Well, a lot of things that would amount to misogynistic behaviour are already criminal. So if you harass somebody, whether online or in real life, that's a crime. If you assault someone, if you commit sexual violence against them, if you make threats to kill, all of those things are already crimes. And there are some specific crimes which have been introduced in the past few years, things like upskirting, which are either to do with the rise in online sexual violence against women or are to do with that. So I think what we have to do is think about, are we currently using the criminal law in the best way possible? Are there tweaks to that criminal law in terms of sentencing? I mean, really what we need to do is change cultural attitudes. And part of that comes from criminalising some things or saying that, you know, up with this, we will not put.
Where Women in Sport sees that there is a question about criminal law, Rachel, what is it? What are the gaps? What are the problems that could be addressed by either the existing laws or further changes?
I think for us, there are a couple of things to say. Number one, we do think that some aspects of misogyny should be criminalised, really to give that up with this, we will not put type signal. The Scottish Government are doing some interesting work on this at the moment. So they are, for example, introducing the idea that misogyny can be used as a something to increase a sentence. And they are proposing to criminalise certain misogynistic crimes, so threats of rape, for example. But I think the other thing that's worth saying is there's always a lot of debate, and there's a lot of debate in this general election campaign around whether we should classify misogyny as a hate crime. Now, completely sympathise and understand the reasoning behind that, but I don't think it fits because women are not a minority and the existing hate crime laws is completely correctly designed to protect minorities. So that's the reason. I know a question that I'm asked occasionally is why, you know, women in sport aren't more vocal in our support of those campaigns, and that's why. We do think specific misogynistic offences should be criminalised, but doing it as a hate crime is potentially a bit problematic.
I'm curious to hear from Ugo on this one about what sports themselves need to do, sports governing bodies around policies to protect women from misogyny.
I think everyone's forever on this journey because I feel as if we're in this biting point generation where we're actually trying to recalibrate and actually try and fix and have a greater sense of equilibrium because of the historical disadvantages that have been unfortunately afforded to women. So we'll never, ever get to the end of this road. But of course, there's more we can do. The number one thing I would say is just change what your boardroom looks like. Have more of a voice, have more of a say. It's too hard for a group of men to speak on behalf of women and understand their full needs. And until we readdress that, then I think we'll always be slightly behind where we want to be.
Rachel, why do we need policies around this area? What change will they bring?
We're not idiots at Women in Sport. We know that just having a policy is not going to, quote unquote, fix misogyny in any particular national governing body of a sport or anywhere else for that matter. But having that policy does send a really powerful signal, number one, to your female participants, coaches, staff, all the rest of it. If you have a good policy, it will also set out the mechanisms by which misogyny can actually be reported and what you're going to do to tackle it, what the penalties are for people who are misogynist or who demonstrate misogynistic behaviour. And I think we've seen, and this is way overdue, but we're starting to see in sport now a move towards thinking more about how, at an institutional level, I guess, more can be done to support minority groups within sports of all different types. So you're seeing a lot of sports now doing more around anti-racism, for example, and not doing enough, by the way, but doing more. And it's quite often a policy that kind of starts that journey. It's often accompanied when you have that policy by some really meaningful training. And by training, I don't just mean the sort of training that those of us who have worked in big corporates will be aware of, where you do half an hour sitting at your desk and you just basically have to tick the statements that aren't homophobic or whatever it might be. It's meaningful training. It's in person. It's delivered by people from the group who are affected. It requires a degree of buy-in and a degree of interactivity that actually leaves people walking away with a meaningful conclusions and some meaningful actions that they can take. And we are starting to see that more in other areas in sport. And that's great. And we would just like misogyny to be treated in the same way, really, because quite apart from the fact that it's just morally a good thing to do, if you look at some of the scandals and the issues that certain NGBs have had in recent years, it's misogyny that's at the root of them. So if they're not doing anything to tackle it, that pattern's just going to keep repeating.
I'd like to end on some positives if we can. Rachel, where do you draw comfort from in changes and the pushback against misogyny?
Look at stories like the recent controversy around the girls' football club that was just told it was going to stop. And they just said, no, sorry, guys. No, we are going to continue playing football because we want to play football. And yes, that had intervention from some really high profile sportswomen. And that was fantastic. But it was mostly those local little girls and their mums and their coaches just going, you know what? No, we're not going to put up with this. We are going to keep playing football. And it's stories like that, as much as anything that happens at the elite level, that give me cause for hope.
Fiona, what about you, whether in sport or in wider society?
I think the fact that we're talking about this is really important, and in fact is the most important thing. You would not have had this conversation 20 or 30 years ago. Now, in some ways, things have got worse. I totally agree with you, Go. The online space is just toxic in every sort of way, but particularly if you're a woman. And there do need to be things that need to be done about that. But I do think in other areas in society, there is a much greater acceptance of the fact that misogyny exists and of the fact that people have to do something about it.
This conversation wouldn't have taken place 5 years ago. It just wouldn't. You've got a lot of men, not a lot of men, but you've got certain men who actually want to jump on the women in sport bandwagon. It's like, what has become that fashionable that you're actually jumping on the bandwagon? Like, women in sport have a bandwagon for us to jump upon. And whilst I absolutely hate those false prophets that actually don't really care for women's sport and women in sport, the fact it's a thing, I think, is quite remarkable. I love the fact that the conversation is seen just commonplace now. Nothing ever can move quite as quickly as you want it to, especially when you're deeply passionate about it. But it's moving. It's generating momentum. It's just here and it's not going anywhere. I love that. That gives me a lot of joy.
Thank you all so much for joining us on this Women in Sport podcast. Hugo Monnier, Fiona Scolding, and Rachel Williams. That's it for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Please remember to like, subscribe, and rate wherever you get your podcasts, and delve into our archive of dozens of interviews and discussions about women in sport. Many thanks to Whistledown Productions in London, where this podcast was recorded. You can go to our website, womeninsport.org, where you can sign up to our newsletter, donate to the charity, and get involved in our work. Thanks for listening, and remember, everyone should be included in the joy, fulfillment, and lifelong benefits of sport. See you next time.